part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Is this Christian?
This is Christian. And how do I pronounce your last name?
You pronounced it right. Heike is correct.
Heike. Oh, okay. Great.
That's very good. Most people, I would say about 70% of the people have a lot more trouble with it, so you got it bang on. I appreciate that.
Great. Well, thank you for coming on Part-Time Fanboy. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Happy to be here.
Great. And so just for anyone who's listening, this is Christian Horn of Part-Time Fanboy, and I've got Mark Heike on the line of AC Comics. What is your official title over there?
Official title these days would be Editor-in-Chief and Publisher.
Oh, okay. So you're like the top dog.
At the moment, I am, but this is a recent development. AC Comics was the brainchild of my longtime boss and very good friend, William Black, who started the company in January of 1983, created everything and was responsible for all things AC. After a lot of years of fighting the month-to-month deadlines, he decided he would like to retire. So we spent a few years trying to figure out a way to work that out, and in May of this year, he was able to pull the trigger. He is now happily ensconced as our editor emeritus.
Uh-huh.
And the day-to-day operation headaches, I get to handle those now.
gotcha. So he founded the company, right? Originally, like in the 70s. So you guys,
Yes. Actually, he started a publishing house known as Paragon Publications.
Yeah.
In 1969.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm. And spent, well, I guess that would be almost 14 years. Publishing and selling his own line of comics, Paragon Publications, which featured a lot of the characters that eventually metamorphosized into what is AC Comics. And with the burgeoning independent comics industry that was growing in the early 80s, he decided to go from the books had been mainly high-quality photo offset black and white books, magazine size, but with the explosion in the independent market in the early 80s, he decided to try to go with something that's actual comic book and comic book format. So in January of 1983, he released what was actually the fourth issue of a series that had started with Paragon Publications called Fun Comics.
Wow. So, I mean, yeah, it's really interesting to me because the way that I sort of like rediscovered your company in a way, mm-hmm. because, you know, and I apologize because I sent you an email and I felt like I may have insulted you a little bit because I was like, I didn't know that AC Comics was still around. Now, the site is called Part-Time Fanboy. And just so you know, like, I generally buy trades these days, you know, I'm not like a regular shopper at like mm-hmm. comic book stores. So that may have been like why I was completely, you know, surprised. And I think is John, I want to pronounce his last name correct as well. John Crowther or Crowther?
I believe it's Crowther, yes.
Yeah, Crowther. And he's doing Rochelle the Teenage Cockroach with you, correct?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. And so my friend Paul, who is also on this podcast mm-hmm. with me every once in a while, had done an interview and reviewed the book. And I was like, wow, I really want to talk to these guys at AC Comics because I knew that you had been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like I hadn't heard anything. So first of all, just, you know, getting that out of the way, I apologize for, you know, hopefully not insulting you in my email saying like, oh, I haven't heard anything.
No, I wasn't insulted. It's just when you've been around as long as we have, one of the great joys in life is to be able to needle people about that.
No, it's great.
One of the unique features of our company, or one of the sort of major decisions, major revelations that our original publisher, Bill Black, made was cost versus results in terms of marketing. And because of that, we have existed our entire history of our company really without a marketing budget. We don't do any marketing.
Really?
Yeah. So we we produce our publications, and we're in previews, you know, Diamond Previews catalog every month, and have been since January of 1983. But we learned early on that, cost versus results on marketing was, in our little corner of the industry, was not worthwhile. So we're not surprised when people say, geez, we thought you went out of business years ago, because we're not visible.
Yeah.
If you go looking for us, we're there. And luckily enough, we have a very devoted, albeit small, audience that keeps us going. But we're not surprised when someone says, hey, we hadn't heard of you in years.
Well,
if you don't go looking, you wouldn't know.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, I mean, that's a real testament to just, like, tenacity, I guess. Because, I mean, there's a lot of people who get started off on, like, small publishing and stuff like that, and then just drop out, like, after several years.
Mm-hmm.
There's people probably freaking out, myself included, that there's no marketing budget. I mean, especially, you know, in the particular job I work at, and then just, you know, reading comic sites like Comic Book Resources, and you just feel like the PR machine is just consistently, like, chugging along. Like, how, I guess, so do you guys just go to conventions, or how do you get the word out?
We did that for some years, but found conventions not quite as much of a dead end as paid advertising, but conventions as well usually were, you know, cost far more than they ever bring in. So we really stopped doing that 4 or 5 years ago. No, we just put the books out. That's all we do.
Oh, that's great. And do you put the? I mean, like, pardon me if this is kind of like a strange. Are you making a profit? Like, is this how you basically make your living? Or
yeah. Yeah, the profit we make is by no means large, but yes, this this takes up all of our time. This is our full time, our one source of income. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing, because I know that there's tons of people who would just love to know, like, the secret of what your success is, because
well, I don't know if there's a secret to it. One of the big advantages we have is when we started. And the fact that very early on, Bill, our publisher, who was a lifelong comic book collector, he decided, well, when we go to press, we're not going to just print to order, you know, to the number of copies that we know our distributors have pre-sold, but we're going to print more so that we have books available to sell as back issues.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course, he started that in 1983 when the company started. So,
yeah.
You know, we've published about 1,000, you know, maybe more than 1,000 individual comic books since then, and every one was printed with the idea of, well, we'll be able to sell back issues.
Wow.
We have a huge backlog of back issues to sell. You know, after the year 2000 or so, we created a commercial website. My wife, Stephanie, actually, who works with me, created that commercial website to sell those online as well as through mail order. And that's an advantage that no one else can have. No one coming into the business now can come in and say, oh, well, by the way, I've got 25 years worth of backlog, back issues that I can sell in addition to putting out the new books.
Sure. Wow. And you also, because when I went doing research, you've got accomics.com, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That's where you sort of buy the, you know, old school, like, media, you know, like paper to have in your hand. But you also have accomics.net, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, and that's where you would buy, which is where I went, you buy some digital editions of the books.
Mm-hmm. We have been experimenting or involved with digital comics online probably about 15 years on and off, not just our own, but working with other people on theirs. And while everyone is certain that that is where the future will be for comics, it is not, in our experience, hasn't really been what you'd call a bonanza yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have a limited number of issues that are available on accomics.net. We're also working with Diamond Distribution. Just this year is starting up a partnership with an outside company that's going to help them market digital comics to a wider audience worldwide. And we're going to be experimenting with a series of graphic novels through them as well. So we're involved in the digital comics world, but it has not been for us. You know, I can't speak for other people, but for us it has not been a bonanza, which is why we're still involved in traditional print publishing. Not only, you know, our heart is there as well because we're old people and we've done this for years, but it's still where, for us, where the money is. That's what keeps us going, is sales of hard copies through Diamond Distribution.
Wow. I mean, that's, you're just totally flipping my mind. Like, you're blowing my mind, because you're going against sort of what the traditional, what, not traditional, you're going against what everyone is saying is the way that it needs to be done these days, like with Comixology and stuff like that. Like, you're basically saying, hey, you don't need marketing, which I'm sure made some people's heads explode. And B, like, digital may not be the profit center or the wave of the future that everyone thinks it is.
Well, if you go back to about 2002, 2003, we were sure that by about 2005, Diamond Distribution would be out of business, no one would be doing print comics, and everyone would be selling online, either downloads or hard copy.
Yeah.
And as I say, for us, the digital downloads have never taken off to be a large source of income. And I will also tell you this, that our online sales of hard copies have gone down quite a bit.
Really?
Our peak was about 2006 or 2007. And I think that is because of people's approach to buying any product online.
Uh-huh.
I think there was a time when we were all used to buying things in retail stores. And the idea was, well, if you saw something on the shelf, you better buy it today if you want it, because in a week or 2 weeks or a month, it may be all sold out. I can't get it anymore.
Uh-huh.
When the online shopping began, people were using the same mindset. But I think as time developed and the internet was out there long enough, people began to realize, since there's no overhead to it, if it's online, you know, it's probably going to be there a while. I don't really have to worry about the fact that, unless they're telling me there's a limited number of these products, if I don't buy it this week, I can buy it next week, I can buy it next year.
Yeah.
I can get it anytime. So I think people's attitudes to buying online have changed.
Interesting.
But the big surprise as well, as you were getting at, is that the sales through comic shops and Diamond for us have not fallen off.
Gotcha.
Traditionally, comic sales for an independent, a small independent, would go down about 1% or 2% a year. And that trend went on with us for over 20 years.
Yeah.
And about 3 or 4 years ago, that stopped.
Huh.
I can't explain it, and I don't know if it has affected any other publisher, but that trend stopped. And our numbers are fairly stable. They bounce up a little bit, they bounce down a little bit, but that drop for us stopped.
Interesting. So you're saying that your main revenue stream, or the largest revenue stream, is coming from actual comic shops?
Overwhelmingly, yes.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, that's good news.
It goes against all conventional wisdom.
Yeah. Wow.
I can't speak, you know, how other publishers are not affected in this way, but that's our experience.
Wow, because, you know, what was really great to me was that I was able to go to, you know, accomics.net, and I don't think I'd read like an issue of, or seen an issue of Femme Force for a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't know the particular origins of the heroines, of the, you know, the heroes and stuff like that. So I was like, let me go start with, you know, number one. And I bought the first four issues. And like, I really feel that you guys are one of the few companies. I mean, I think now some companies through Comixology have been doing it this way, but who are doing like the digital distribution the way that I kind of want to see it done, which is basically like, here, it's a PDF. You can download it. You don't need anything else, you know, to read it. You don't need an app. You don't need like a special program or anything. You can just, you know, read it on your laptop, and you get to keep it, you know, for as long as you want. It's basically a file on your computer. And not only that, but you, which this kind of surprised me too, you give the color version of the comic, and then on the back of the PDF, or towards the end of the PDF, once that's over, you give the black and white version of the comic so you can see the line art. That's fantastic.
Well, since all of us start from a background of being mainly artists, that sort of stuff really appeals to us. We think of going back to the black and white line art as that's sort of really what the artist hand put down on the paper. So we're always fascinated by that.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I should mention is the price is only 95 cents. Like, what was the decision? I mean, like, did you just, because it seems like that to a lot of fans, like comic fans, seems, or like iTunes and stuff like that, seems to be the magic price point. Is that why you went with that? You just said like 95 cents is feasible, or like whatever you want?
I was not involved in the decision-making process on that per se, but I would assume that that was it, looking at comparable products and saying, well, what is it worth, you know, what is the going rate that people respond to? The economy of scale on downloadable stuff is so different than the things that that affect the sale of hard copy, that you can, especially with material that has gone through the system in terms of being a print product and being sold as a back issue, and oftentimes close to or completely sold out as a back issue, you can afford to look at a price point that's more reasonable, and with the idea that, well, it's going to encourage a lot more people to take a chance on it.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I bought the first four issues, and I had never read, like, you know, the first couple of issues of like Femme Force. Mm-hmm. But I read the first two last night, and I gotta say, like, I was very surprised. Like, I don't know what I was expecting, but obviously this is a book that was published, you know, in the 80s, but I really kind of enjoyed what I read. I don't know what I expected. I expected more of a salacious read than what I got, but it was very sort of like wholesome and straightforward. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And it's again, this is nothing that we have heard before. Most of the people who have not read AC or read a lot of AC look at the books on the surface, and that is what they assume. One of the ideas in starting up the line of books and putting the slant on the going back to Paragon Publications days, when Bill initially created the characters for that line, was that these would be female characters that exuded a certain amount of pin-up sexuality. You know,
sure.
They would wear skimpy costumes, and the Paragon books would be a little more daring than what you would get in mainstream comics.
Uh-huh.
Well, and that was Bill's attitude, and that was what he thought as a reader. You know, this is what I can't buy anywhere else. I would enjoy reading this. So
yeah.
I will do this kind of material. And since that time, and what we're talking about is going back to maybe 1970, when he's thinking in terms of this, the rest of the world has changed so much that the aspect of sexuality is so much more prevalent in media that the rest of the world has completely passed this by.
Probably
two or three, maybe four decades ago, but that's where Bill's mindset has always stayed. And that was sort of the level that the books were kept at in terms of that. But we were all fascinated with telling stories. You know, we grew up reading Marvel Comics. I grew up reading Marvel Comics. Bill is a little older than I, so he went back further than that. But we're fascinated with telling stories. So once the idea that you've got these glamorized female heroines as the centerpiece of your stories, then we want to get down to telling fun and interesting stories.
So yeah.
People look at the surface and assume, well, this is some sort of fetish comic book, you know, for guys only.
Yeah.
But that, you know, our interest in that aspect stayed where it was, never went beyond that, and we got into wanting to tell the stories. And once you work with these characters for years, that's sort of, as a creator, where your fascination is.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting, because I remember the first time I ever saw an issue of Femme Force, and mm-hmm. the first issue I ever bought was number 4, and mm-hmm. it was sort of like when I had first discovered comic book shops, and I picked it up, you know, thinking like, oh, this looks kind of interesting. I think it was like Ms. Victory, that I always loved, like the Captain America type characters, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, she looks like a female Captain America, let me just pick this up. And I remember reading it and, you know, being liking it. But at the same time, what's really funny to me is you talk about sort of like the pinup nature of aspect of the characters or the books. But you guys were kind of like trailblazers in that aspect, because by the end of the 80s, like early 90s, like Image and even Marvel to a certain extent were just going crazy with that stuff, right?
Exactly, yeah. And when Bill started it, there was no one doing this. No one. So, yeah. It was sort of something new in the marketplace, and that's why I think why the book was able to get an early foothold.
Yeah. And when I say like pinup nature, though, that's the thing is like obviously looking at the books last night, the costumes were a little skimpy, but it's really funny because I've always posited that it's sort of the way you draw particular characters that is what makes them sort of like appropriate, inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And I didn't necessarily find anything like insanely inappropriate in at least the first two issues that I reread last night.
Well, that's, again, we have a line that we're not interested in crossing, both in terms of the material we produce and in sort of respect for the characters.
Sure. No, I mean, I have to say I was very like pleasantly surprised with what I read. And you know, it's the sort of thing where, like I said earlier, they were like wholesome. It was just like an adventure story. And mm-hmm. and exactly. I got to say, like, it definitely makes me want to maybe pick up more of the digital books.
Oh, we like to hear that.
So can you talk to me a little bit about just AC Comics in general, possibly like Femme? Because it seems to me like Femme Force would probably be the most popular title. Am I wrong about that?
No, definitely. When the company... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, what... Was Femme Force the first book or of, like, officially of AC Comics, or...?
No, actually not at all. Again, when Bill launched the line in 83, he had a number of established superhero characters that had been running in his Paragon Publications book. And his original idea was, basically a very full line of comic books, different types, different characters. And he had several male characters that were very popular in Paragon Publications, Captain Paragon and the Scarlet Scorpion. And he was going to did a group book called The Sentinels of Justice that teamed up a number of costume characters. And there's a science fiction, outer space-based character called Bolt. Well, all this was done in 1983 and 1984, when the independent market was burgeoning, as it were, and everyone was sort of feeling their way through, seeing how things were going to go, and within about a year and a half, the entire independent market almost crashed.
Yeah.
Put a lot of the initial companies out of business. And like everyone else, AC had to cut back, and this is about this time some of the other publishers were experimenting with black and white books because it would cost a lot less to produce. So in a sort of a slack period, Bill thought, well, okay, we got to put something out to generate some money to keep us going while we figure out how to reinvent the company. And he remembered that he had his appeal or his greatest interest in doing the Paragon books was the female characters.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, well, no one else is doing this. Let's try a book. Excuse me. Featuring all female superheroes, and he had some material in hand, already finished but never published, and he thought, well, I'm going to take these individual stories and I'm going to edit them together into a group book. And he did a special in 1984, the Femme Force special, which did exactly that, and that was the best-selling book of the year for AC.
Uh-huh.
Didn't need a house to drop on Bill, and he decided, well, we should probably start a series. And then by the next year, he had started the first issue of what was then the Color series. But the company had been in business certainly 2 years before Femme Force came about.
Oh.
It was actually an idea of an all-female group of superheroines Bill came up with in the mid-70s when he was freelancing for Marvel.
Yeah.
He was an anchor on books like Invaders and What If for a short time and working with editor Roy Thomas, editor and writer, and he had suggested to Roy the idea of an all female team of superheroes and Marvel heroes, you know. And Roy, being Roy, said, oh, no, that will never sell. People don't buy female comic book characters.
Uh-huh.
So Bill just put that idea in his hat and sat on it. And, you know, it was about 10 years later when he was casting about for something to do, as we say, a temporary black and white stopgap to bring in some cash. He tried the Femme Force idea, and it was a big winner.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that's so interesting because you know that, like, this week or yesterday, Marvel just announced like an all-female team of Avengers, right?
Actually, I didn't hear about that.
Oh, no. They just announced like, I think it's called like A-Force or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be like an all-female team of Avengers. And then Also, you know, throughout the years, there were several times where, you know, the X-Men were mostly female members.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like in a way that you guys were trailblazers.
Well, I can't say no to that. we think so, too. And that's, again, part of the reasons why Bill tried what he did, because he knew, well, looking at the marketplace, there's nothing else like this. Let's try it.
Yeah. So Femme Force was a hit, like, right out of the box for you guys.
Yeah, unexpectedly, yes.
Yeah.
So within 6 months, he had started the regular ongoing series. And with fits and starts and a few problems along the way, we have been publishing that ever since.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about Femme Force? Like, what are the characters? What is the basic concept is an all-female team of superheroes, but beyond that?
Well, the nominal star of the book is the leader of the team that you had mentioned earlier, Ms. Victory. And she started out as a government operative that became a costumed operative for the U.S. government. And eventually was led to a sort of a mad scientist type, although he was working for the government at the time, that became her mentor and gave her some training and some superpowers and later married her.
Uh-huh.
That marriage did not go well and did not last long. In her civilian life, she went on to have a very distinguished career as a genetic biologist, and continued her career as a superheroine. When World War II broke out, basically in our continuity, it was Eleanor Roosevelt that suggested the teaming of Ms. Victory with some other costumed vigilantes that formed the Femme Force. And they continued to operate through the 1940s and 50s and 60s. Before her marriage broke up, Ms. Victory had a daughter, that she raised as a single mother. She eventually married, in recent times, the Captain Paragon character.
Uh-huh.
In our universe. And she had, for many years, taken a chemical formula that gave her not only superpowers, but allowed her to change back and forth from her normal chronological self to a much younger superpowered self. And through her relationship with Paragon, they determined that it may not be necessary for her to continue to take that drug.
Uh-huh.
So she basically arranged the demise of her civilian ID and basically now exists just as Ms. Victory. And it's kind of funny because the Paragon character, who originally was perhaps going to be the star of the AC Comics line in 1983 when it was all started, continues to be a supporting character in the Femme Force book as Ms. Victory's husband. And as Bill has sometimes joked, it almost seems like he's her sidekick.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
That's what trans conventions on a few years, but he will have his time in the spotlight as well.
Wow, that's great. I mean, and then she's joined by other characters, like there's one of them is She-Cat. And
exactly, yeah. She-Cat is was originally the daughter of an archaeologist who was possessed by a sort of a deity or demon that was, I don't want to say an Egyptian deity, I would say recognized in Egyptian mythology as a deity or demon known as Sekhmet, sort of a cat demon. And Sekhmet itself is not good or evil, but rather amoral.
Uh-huh.
It's not an easily controllable force, and it has taken She-Cat many years of being possessed by his demon to come to grips with sort of its more savage side. But that's sort of the source of her powers. In addition to She-Cat, other team members are Night Vale, who started her career as a non-powered costumed adventurer known as the Blue Bulleteer,
uh-huh,
who operated through the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s, till she was selected by an other dimensional creature to learn sorcery and with the idea of becoming the defender of his world. And once she successfully did that, she was able to return to Earth and assume the role of Night Vale, who is sort of the Sorceress Supreme of our universe. At the moment, she's sort of involved in a crisis where she's probably going to lose a lot of her mystical powers, back battling on the world where she gained her initial mystical abilities.
Uh-huh.
Other members added to the group were Stardust, who is an alien woman that comes from a planet called Ruhr, which is an all-female planet that lives in... they have sort of a hive society, a hive mentality. So their social structure is completely different from normal Earth. And she comes at things from a very different mindset, but has, through an interesting series of events, she decided to make Earth her adopted home.
Uh-huh.
And she is a member of the Fem Force. She also works as a consultant at NASA.
Uh-huh.
In her off hours. And in addition to that, Tara Fremont is also a member of the Fem Force. She came to the Fem Force a little later. She is the daughter of a very wealthy multinational conglomerate owner, T.C. Fremont. And her main focus through the early part of her life was basically the green movement, conservation, the ecology. She particularly loved animals. And her father gave her an island that she turned into a nature preserve. She had been called in on a special mission with the Fem Force, so she worked with them a little bit, and then at one point she accidentally slipped the formula against her will that gave her the ability to change her size.
Oh.
She can now become giant-sized, and she has worked continued to work with the Fem Force as a regular member since then.
God. Oh, wow. It's really interesting because my assumption is that a lot of these stories developed in the 80s, and from the background that you gave me on some of them just now, and mm-hmm. especially Ms. Victory, I mean, they seem like very, you know, they're female characters that were very lacking in the 70s and 80s as far as like the other companies were putting out. Like you've got like women who are scientists, women who are mm-hmm. adventurers, women who mm-hmm. are, you know, have something that they're interested in other than the superheroing. And
yeah.
And that also seems very forward thinking and sort of, you know, I don't know that people would expect this of a book that, you know, like you said, and what I've noticed that that is on the face, you know, mm-hmm. Fem Force, that would expect that of it. You know what I'm saying? And it's, the characters are very well developed.
Well, we've got 35 years plus of continuity now.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And I mean, just the rundown that you're giving me of it, because there's always the complaint that, you know, you've got like these female characters that are cardboard cutouts or mm-hmm. just, you know, made for men to oogle at. And, you know, there's mm-hmm. the aspect of that. But at the same time, it seems that you guys have very much grounded them with, you know, aspects of personality and backgrounds that are very fully fleshed out.
Well, we have to remain fascinated and interested in the characters to want to continue to do them and do a good job on it. So these characters have become the sort of people that we would find interesting. And while they're by no means perfect, we try to make them the kind of people that we would want to admire, that we would think would you know, add a positive force to the world.
So yeah.
In order to do that, they've got to be a little bit more than two-dimensional. And the advantage of having the same core group, or at least a couple of the same core group of creators working on them over this length of time, gives you the opportunity to do that. If you're a normal comic book publisher and you have to hire new artists and writers every time your creators move on, it's a little harder to build that sort of consistent backstory. But if you've got the same people, you know, Bill wrote these for years, and I really hadn't been doing a lot of writing until about the last 15 years or so, and having had a grounding of working with him on these characters every day for years, I had a pretty good feel for where to go with them when the time was right for me to start writing more. So
yeah,
and we try to do, we're always sort of drives us crazy to read comic books that ignore past continuity.
Yeah.
What we do, even if sometimes occasionally outside people may have thrown in things we don't like, we try to work with it to get past it or get rid of it. We don't really like to abandon it and just start over. And we don't really have any intention of ever doing any sort of complete makeover and, you know, go back to ground zero and start the characters over again, because to me, that's a little too easy. That's almost a cheat.
Sure. You never did a reset or anything like that?
Not a big time reset. No, not a reset that would just wipe out all the continuity and start over. No.
Wow, that's impressive. I mean, the fact that you guys have stuck with the same core of characters, and that it's generally the same group of people who have been putting this book out. I mean, you don't hear that about a lot of, you know, creators, maybe like Eric Larson or you know, Cerebus.
Who started with us, by the way.
What's that?
Eric started with us.
Oh, really?
Sure. He drew Night Vale, and in fact, he followed me. I was the original artist on the Night Vale solo book. He followed me, and he also drew the Sentinels of Justice for AC and for Bolt. So in 1984 and 85, he did a lot of artwork for AC Comics.
Gotcha.
Well, so we got to know Eric a little bit over the years. He's pretty good. He's a little goofy, but he's a good guy.
If you say so. I've never had the opportunity to meet him in person.
No one loves comic books more than Eric Larson.
That's what I hear. And you can definitely see that when you check out an issue of Savage Dragon. So,
mm-hmm.
Let me ask you about the sort of public domain aspect, because that's sort of, which characters are created from whole cloth and which ones were sort of pulled out of, because that's my understanding and a little bit of reading that I did online, you know, like the Wikipedia page said that many of the characters were developed out of characters that had lapsed into the public domain.
Well, we have a real bone to pick with Wikipedia. And a lot of stuff on that. Again, I cannot address what their policy is or how other factoids are handled on there. I can only talk about the material they have on there that's based on AC Comics, and a lot of it is just flat wrong.
Okay.
And one of the problems we've had in attempting to use their system and edit it and to correct it is that what Wikipedia appears to require is they need you to reference material to other sources online that basically prove what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
And the go-around that Bill had with them for years was, what do you mean someplace online? I'm the guy that did this.
Yeah.
that's not good enough for them.
So yeah.
We have not been able to correct a lot of the inaccuracies in Wikipedia.
So what are the inaccuracies?
I can't go chapter and verse.
No, sure, sure.
Don't want to, but that allows me to dovetail into this discussion. That I am loath to use the term public domain, which gets thrown around a lot these days, based on discussions we had with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office when we were investigating the use of material that was previously printed.
Uh-huh.
And as they told me, they said public domain is a status that it can only be conferred in court. In other words, assume everything is prior claimed until you go to court and have a judge rule something in public domain.
Oh.
I don't like to use the term PD, although a lot of people throw it around. There is material that is out of copyright because of the difference between the rights that are affected under copyright and trademark, which are two different things, that makes the whole aspect of rights to something that's previously been in print very complicated, and it really varies on a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
I will say that some of the characters in the Femme Force were originally inspired by pre-existing characters that go back to the Golden Age.
Sure.
When we started all this, we thought that would be a big deal. We assumed, well, you know, that will get people interested and make people want to buy it because our own original ideas, they won't be that fascinated with. We found out that was completely wrong, that the people that are interested in Golden Age characters are, that grouping is very small, and those that are interested pretty much only in the original books themselves.
Uh-huh.
People who are interested in Golden Age revivals is a really tiny group.
Oh, that's interesting, because it seems to be a thing that's taken off with certain other companies like Dynamite and other publishers. And it's another thing that, you know, if you had maybe sort of, you know, however you feel about it, sort of pulled from a base of like Golden Age characters,
mm-hmm.
it seems like you guys were, again, ahead of the curve.
Well, yes. And one of the things we told a lot of those people going in is don't get your hopes up, because people are not fascinated with this and they're not interested in it.
Sure.
And I will say that this trend, I would say, comes from desperation.
Oh.
And the fact that a lot of people are doing it, I don't think is evidence that there's any market for it, but rather that this is something we can do without costing us a lot of money, so we'll try it.
Gotcha.
But to finish my original thought, we found that the new ideas that we brought, the new changes, the metamorphosizing of these characters into something completely original, was far more interesting to our readers than the original inspiration. So at this point, since the characters that we used had appeared so infrequently in the Golden Age, as far as their inspiration goes, what we have done is make these characters something completely new and completely original. And we really don't bother much with the whole aspect of what the original inspiration was, because no one else seemed to care either. And we look at what we have done now as really original characters, and don't even like to talk a whole lot about the fact that, well, they may have been originally inspired by characters from defunct publishers.
Sure, sure, sure. Now, can I ask you about, because you started off as an artist?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, that was my goal, was to work in the comic book industry as an artist. And I started out freelancing for Paragon Publications for Bill in 1980. In addition to that, through the 80s and 90s, even while working full-time at AC, I would freelance. I did work for Marvel and DC, and a lot of the defunct independents like First Comics and Acclaim and things like that. In 1990, Bill was looking at expanding the company because it looked like the independent comic book world was on the upswing again and might take some expansion. And he had some bad experiences with other people that he worked with before, but he had been working with me for a long time. And he said, well, why don't you move down to Florida and take a job with me as an associate editor, and we'll see if we can put out some more books. So,
oh, wow.
I made the move in May of 1990 and learned everything I know about making comic books from Bill.
Uh-huh. Wow. So, yeah, so, and now you're like the big dog.
Well, It came down to the fact that because Bill had enough and wanted to pursue a little bit more reasonable schedule in his life, and I can't blame him, it was either we'd figure out some way that I could keep things going, or that would be the end of AC Comics.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to see that happen, and I wanted to continue working with the characters, and Bill liked that idea as well. So we sort of worked out a system and a deal here so that I'm going to keep things going. And I try to keep them going in the same spirit, with the same ideas and ideals that Bill has had all along.
Yeah. And what I noticed in the first two issues that I read is that you are either credited as the inker or the full-on artist on the book. Like, that's pretty cool.
Over the years, I've had to learn, well, no, I shouldn't say I had to, I've lucky enough to learn how to do just about everything involved in the phase of comic book production. The only thing I was never really very good at was hand lettering. But I started out as a penciler, was also interested in inking, so I did a lot of both of that. Started doing a little bit of writing, got into more of that. And nowadays, there really isn't much time for me to do any artwork at all.
Uh-huh.
Mainly making sure the book's out and writing and editing what comes in, sort of the main focus. And that's
yeah,
a pretty time-consuming job, so...
Well, I guess one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about your sort of like history with the company and, you know, your history as an artist, it seems like, and just through a cursory glance of your catalog, that, you know, Femme Force at least and a lot of the other books have sort of maintained an artistic style. Like they haven't really, or at least, you know, like I said, a cursory glance, they haven't really jumped around like the rest of the industry as far as like, you know, whatever the hot style was, like say, oh, this is the Image style. And this was like the Marvel style. Like you guys kind of stuck with the way that you illustrated your books, you know, and can you speak to that a little bit or am I incorrect?
No, you are correct. And it has been basically a conscious choice. We did attempt in the early 90s to go with the flow. You know, we were looking at what else was going on around us as well, what appeared to be successful, and what people were doing, and tried to do it in terms of approach and style. And basically, when we had those things ready to launch and showed them to retailers at the major distributors who do retailer conferences, which were much like a comic book convention, only open to retailers, you know,
sure,
to publishers and present. And we showed this material to retailers, and they almost unanimously said, no, don't do this. Don't do this. You're not doing it right. Other companies are doing this stuff. Do what you do.
Uh-huh.
You know, do what you do best and do it your way.
Gotcha.
And that sort of, we learned from that. And
yeah,
we also decided, well, you know, that's what we'd rather do anyway. So it was at about that time that we decided, well, we're not going to close our eyes to the industry, but we're going to go ahead forward and act on trends and industry changes that we know from experience are or not effective. Other than that, we're going to do what we think is best and, you know, let the world revolve around us, and we'll either sink or swim.
And so I'm assuming that obviously, you know, you have... like obviously things have changed. Like it's not like hand coloring, it's computer coloring. Like do you produce pages of art like traditionally, or is it digitally, or what is the work process as far as like the actual content is concerned?
Well, as far as the actual artwork, it's mainly traditionally. Of course, we use the digital aspect to expedite all sorts of production, but the artwork is still, for the most part, hand-drawn on paper.
Oh, that's great.
And we have some outside freelancers, inkers and things that work with us to do a lot of that completely digital, and that's still sort of a mystifying process to me. I'm not even quite sure how that's done. But essentially, everything starts out on paper.
Sure.
Even right through the inking process, and then it's scanned in to you know, graphics programs. And we did have someone that just hand lettered a story a few issues ago, but that's the first hand-lettered story we've done in years. All the lettering is done digitally, and a certain amount of the pre-press.
Uh-huh.
And our interiors, we have been strictly black and white since, I think, 1997, so the covers are color, and that, of course, is done digitally.
Sure, sure. Oh, wow, that's you know, that's really interesting. That, how do you find your artists? I mean, if you're not going to conventions, is there, can people, well, like, how did you find John Crowther or Crowther?
Well, like John Crowther, they come to us.
Oh, really?
And John came to us late last summer, I guess, at about the same time. An old creator of ours, Del Barris, who's worked for many years in animation and did a lot of stuff over the years for Marvel and DC as well. He had done work for us in the late 80s, and we'd always loved his artwork. And like I said, he got busy in animation for about 20 years and was out of the business. And he came, called us out of the blue in August and said, hey, I want to get back into doing comics. I want to do some stuff for you. And that, we got very excited about that. And he's done a story, and he's going to do some covers. He'd also mentioned in passing other things he was involved with. And he had mentioned John Crowther and Rochelle the Teen Cockroach. And we chuckled a little bit about it, and a couple of days later, John Crowther called us.
Uh-huh.
And since over the years, our experiments, AC's experiments with creator-owned properties have not been very successful, our normal policy is we don't deal with creator-owned properties. We deal with our own trademark characters. But John told us a little bit about the character, and initially I said, no, you know, I think you're better off finding someone else to publish this. But then we thought about it for a few days, and he thought, well, his idea, a female superheroine, is not that far off from Femforce. He thought, well, we will give it a shot.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why Rochelle is going to be in Femforce. It's, as we're going to make clear in the book, this is completely a creation of John Crowther, and he and Del Barris own everything about it. It's just sort of a guest appearance. There may be more guest appearances. That remains to be seen. John seems open to that, and we're open to that, depending on how well it does. But he just sort of came to us out of the blue, and the fact that he was working with an artist that we knew was very experienced and very skilled,
yeah,
goes a long way toward the fact that we considered it. Anyone who read the story, we said, well, you know, this really isn't bad. This is pretty decent. We'll see if our fans support it. And as we've told John, if and when he can find a publisher that can take this bigger and better places, you know, by all means, go.
Oh, that's so cool. wow, that's really nice of you guys. You know, because a lot of people, like, if something take, you know, I mean, you hear all the tales of grief. You guys do something, you guys do everything completely, not wrong, but different than yeah. how I hear about it every place else.
Absolutely, yeah. We often wonder about the, as you say, the public relations machines and what other companies have to say about how and why they do things. And we just know from experience, we've learned to take all that with a grain of salt. Initially, we were pretty gullible, too, and looked at whatever we saw in print. You know, oh, if there's a lot of it talked everywhere, this must be a big deal, this must be success, this must be the way it is. And then you experience it, you try some of the same things and find out, well, no, that may be just a lot of public relations nonsense.
Wow. Well, I know we're coming up on an hour, and I don't want to take up too much more of your time. You've been so very generous. I guess the last thing that I was curious about was the videos. Like, mm-hmm. is Mr. Black producing those? Or, like,
yeah.
there's, like, a Night Vale movie or something?
Oh, yes. Well, the only thing that our original publisher, Bill, loves more than comic books is movies. And that is where his heart has always really been. In fact, before AC Comics, he worked in the audiovisual field producing educational and promotional industrial films. And the technology for making your own movies, if you go back to the 70s, was very cumbersome, expensive, and difficult.
Sure.
With the digital revolution, he could see that it would be possible for a single guy with a camera to make some pretty high-quality movies. So he got fascinated with that about 15 years ago and went with doing that full-time almost 10 years ago, and he's continuing to work on his films and videos in what he laughingly calls his retirement. So that's where his complete focus is. Yes, he writes them, produces them, films them.
Where can people find these?
Well, he has a separate website to sell those both as hard copy and downloads right now, and it is nightvalemedia.com.
Gotcha.
And there's a link to that from our acomics.com site as well. But I encourage anyone and everyone who's interested to go there, because he does a lot of fun and interesting stuff. And it's kind of cool to see these characters that have been just comic book images for years live and in color and video.
Wow, that's great. That's really cool. So does Femfor still come out monthly pretty much?
We are currently doing it quarterly, and I don't want to get into too much of a dissertation here, but
sure.
The constraints that Diamond Distribution, which is the only distributor left in the comic book market, thank goodness they're still there, they have a certain constraints in terms of how much money a particular product generates for them, or they can't carry that in their catalog, which is completely sensible. I
sure.
don't argue with that at all. Anyway, we've had to alter the sort of package that we produce to fit in with Diamond Distribution policies. So that what we do now is Femforce is an 80-page book, 80 pages of all new material that comes out four times a year.
Gotcha.
So when you add that all up, that comes out to being about as much that you get in 12, 32-page issues if you did a monthly book. But because of the price point we have to put on it, which is $9.95 for 80 pages, the price point we put on it allows us to generate enough money to satisfy Diamond so that they continue to happily carry us as a product. So we do it four times a year, 80 pages four times a year.
Okay, wow, that's great. And is there anything else that you would like people to know about yourself, your company, anything that I've missed? Or
I think you've covered a lot of important points very well. all I can say is we are committed to our characters. We love them. We enjoy doing them. And we hope that comes through in the stories that we do.
Well, that's so great. And, you know, like I said, I'm probably going to be picking up more of the digital stuff because, you know, as has been mentioned online or when I was looking around, the original, you know, issues are kind of harder to come by. But, I really enjoyed what I found. I mean, it was a very pleasant surprise, and I didn't know what to expect, quite honestly, because it had been, like I said, a long time, and I was woefully ignorant, and I apologize for that. But, you know, I really enjoyed what I found, and I think you guys are doing digital comics right, like one of the few people who are like, here, have the digital file, and look, there's like a whole extra book without the color, like, so you can analyze the art. I mean, as, you know... a cartoonist myself, it's like that was just like, oh, this is great. So I think that, you know, it's just really great to see you guys still, you know, plugging at it and still and doing it from, you know, my perspective, it seems the right way.
Well, that's good to hear. I'm glad we're doing something right. We'll Great. Try to keep it up.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate it. You know, to anyone who's been listening, that has been Mark Heike, right?
Yes, it has.
Thank yeah, from AC Comics, and I am Christian Horn, and this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. All right, great. Take care.
You too.